Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Computer Weekly Downtime Upload Podcast. I'm Cliff Saren and my guest today is Jonathan Schneider of Modern. I've been reading a bit about your background and open rewrite, Jonathan. So that's a good place to start. But from the company website, I can see that you were once at Netflix. And what it says here, looking at the Modern website, it says that you got a bit fed up of hearing, "Do it for me and I'm happy to accept the change." So tell me some more about that.
That's right. Yeah, I was working on a central team there, a central engineering tools team, and we were somewhat responsible for moving the code base forward. Mm. But because of this freedom and responsibility culture at Netflix at that time, we couldn't impose constraints on what product engineers did. So say I wanted to move them forward from one language version to another, I couldn't say on a particular date, if you're not where we want you to be, we're going to just break your build. You know, so that yes. you would have to come along with us. We spent a lot of effort building essentially early forms of internal developer portals, trying to surface context to developers about where they were relative to where we wanted them to be. Hmm. And it resulted in approximately no action, right? They would just not do anything. And if I would talk to a product engineer and say, "What could I do? What kind of context could I provide you that would help you move along?" They'd say, you know, "Do it for me, right? I've just got this big feature burden behind me. I don't have time for this. I'm not going to do it."
So your background is sort of supporting the coders.
That's right. An engineering tools function. Now you could call that developer experience or developer productivity, but as you know, a central team helping others be more productive.
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking at platform engineering, and I guess that sort of fits
platform
into
engineering is part of that. Yes, function.
We'll probably touch on that a bit later on. Now, I know that you're part of the Microsoft Startup Pegasus program. Is that something that you guys are involved in?
That's right. Yeah. So
how did that happen?
It's something that Microsoft is always seeking capabilities that are important to their key customers that they feel like they don't have a solution for right now. So they're trying to pair solutions with customer needs. And in this case, I think they had talked to enough engineering executives and leaders that are trying to accelerate application modernization. And so tapped Moderna as a solution that could help achieve that. Especially in their larger enterprise customers. The benefit to us sort of mutually, first on our side, you know, Microsoft helped us get through an Azure Marketplace listing very quickly, kind of cut through a lot of the tape there. And so we're able to co-sell with Microsoft. And I think it's just better for both of us, really.
And has that worked? I mean, being on the Azure Marketplace and... there's a lot of software on the Azure Marketplace, right? How do you get noticed?
Yes, in this particular case, Pegasus puts you in a sort of preferred place on the marketplace. You're not just kind of there in the sea of all the other solutions. They also, as part of this program, basically allow Microsoft reps to retire quota against this product, and so it's a more direct co-selling arrangement than just being, just having a normal marketplace listing.
Hmm. I mean, I guess there's a lot of people interested in application modernization. What's your take on that? How do we get around this problem that every piece of code you create is, you know, basically ends up as legacy the day it's deployed?
That's right. Yeah, that's a key insight there, is I could make all the perfect decisions around an application's architecture and pick all the best libraries and best solutions today, and 2 months from now, it's not optimal for one reason or another. Mm. Historically, we've either put it back in the hands of those product engineers to continue to revise the application going forward to keep it up to date, keeping the lights on, or we get behind on this kind of activity and You've probably heard of things like software factories, where a co large consultancy comes in and tries to just work on applications one at a time, somewhat painfully. There's a great talk out there from Dov Katz at Morgan Stanley where he talks about this problem and says, I almost think of software factories as the F word now, because this kind of laborious one application at a time effort has just not worked. So we try to think of the problem, rather than thinking about it one application at a time per task, we think about what tasks can we solve horizontally across whole business units. So say I'm trying to move, I think of a particular example from one of the other large banks. They're trying to solve one vulnerability. Well, the minimum fixed version of the library requires Java 17, and they're on Java 8. But they're pinned to Java 8 because they're on WebSphere. So unless they move an application from WebSphere to Tomcat, Java 8 to 17, then they can't move that library. So can we think about this horizontally for all 3,000 of these applications and just go WebSphere to Tomcat first? Then we do Java 8 to 17, then we do the vulnerability fix at the very end. And I think that makes it more tractable for enterprises to plan.
I mean, you've actually mentioned Java, and what I wanted to follow up on, I'm jumping between questions here, but there's two things actually, and it is sort of related to legacy IT. I mean, I remember writing about Java when it first appeared, right? So it's been around a long time, and it's been
Yes.
in the enterprise a long time. But a lot has changed with Java, and I mean, I speak to a company called Azal, and I think you're
Yes.
sort of partners with them. I mean, how does what we're talking about in terms of application modernization, and I guess people are also refactoring applications. I mean, how does that all come together when you're looking at Java and the Java JDK?
Well, I think there's many efforts underfoot at once. It's Java version upgrades, it's framework updates, like trying to move from Spring Boot 1 to 2 to 3, or sometimes it's something we call tech stack liquidity, which is trying to change from one tech stack to another to consolidate. And that WebSphere to Tomcat example is a good example of this. As it relates to Azul, what Azul really possesses is information about the runtime reachability of various parts of the code. Has a particular method, has a particular class been executed or exercised in a production environment? So for us, that's just an additional data source that we plug into our recipes that are operating on what we call the lossless semantic tree, or rich form of code, to do things, first of all, like unused code elimination. If it's not being exercised, add a deprecation, elevate the severity of that deprecation, and eventually just remove it. But it also can be used to do prioritization exercises, like if I'm going to do a large scale fix, code that is not often reached has a lower risk surface area than code that's frequently reached, and so it's just one of many signals that we use to do risk prioritization, for applying changes across the board.
So I mean, tell me a little bit about the some of the technology that you have at Modern and the products.
Sure. So really going back to Open Rewrite, which is Open Rewrite is an Apache licensed framework for really programmatic large scale code transformation. Open Rewrite has two real essential components. One is what we call the lossless semantic tree, and this is you think of the text to code, then the abstract syntax tree of code. This is like the abstract syntax tree, but also everything the compiler knows about those symbols. So all that symbol solving, plus all the formatting of the original code, transitive dependencies, other things that were metadata that we're stuffing onto that tree. So it's a similar information density about a piece of code that the IDE has, indexed in memory when you're operating on something, but we'll produce that data model, that lossless semantic tree, in the form of serialized artifacts for the entirety of an enterprise code base. Then what happens with that data? So it's kind of like a data lake, a very rich representation of the code. Then there's these things called programs, which are recipes, which are programs that iterate over that tree and either make tree mutations or changes, or just extract data out in the form
Why
of data tables.
is that useful? Why is that important?
The extraction of data.
Yes.
This is
Well,
something we didn't
the whole,
wasn't obvious,
looking at
the
the
whole
tree,
thing.
yes, the whole thing, what you were describing there. It's just because, I mean, I understand what you just said, the first bit about how it's set up, but then this bit about iterating over the tree and stuff like that, that probably needs a bit of explanation.
It's when, if you're, let's think about one of the original Netflix use cases. We actually had an internal li logging library called Blitz4j that we had regretted, and wanted to just replace it with open source SLF4j. And so you're looking through the code and you see statements like logger.info and then some arguments after it. And just looking at the text of that code, it's actually unclear whether that logger is a Blitz4j logger or an SLF4j logger or something else entirely. What's helpful to have about that, all that compiler symbol information on that particular method call logger.info, is we can basically identify what that type is and where exactly it comes from, so that a recipe that's attempting to make a change to it can, without any false positive or inaccuracy, really narrow its scope of changes to the applicable surface area.
Gosh, that sounds like a sort of tall order, the
It is a it's a very
replacing one
tall
fu
order.
function with another function and being able to identify that something called logger dot whatever is actually
Is a
the one
particular
that you
thing.
mean.
That's right. And this is a very small thing, of course. Now these recipes stack into higher and higher and higher order units of encapsulation. So they're co compositional in nature. Something like a Spring Boot 3.4 migration today, the recipe has 3,400 such steps to it. And that, so to migrate to 3.4, you have to get to 3.3, which means you have to get to 3.2, which means you get to 3.1, which means you get to 3.0, which means you have to migrate to Java 17, which means you have to get to 11, which means you have to get to 8. So these recipes will stack like this on top of one another, building higher and higher order units of functionality in terms of moving people forward.
I've got on my list of questions one about Modi. Is that some kind of AI?
We at this point have developed, of course, thousands of these recipes. And something I just alluded to a moment ago is recipes can emit this data called data tables, which are just rows and columns of information according to a schema of the recipe's choosing. So as a recipe's going through the code base, it can just kind of send off rows of data. And if you imagine aggregating those rows of data into one big table for a whole business unit, you can use these recipes to extract, to basically study things at scale. Now, last year, when tool function calling really became this new paradigm for large language models, we realized that while we have thousands of tools that can be exposed to a model to do various things, whether it be an impact analysis or a change on code. And so with Moti, we've essentially exposed all of these recipes and all those that LST data to an LLM. And then when you ask a model a question like, tell me how a particular middleware cache is used throughout my code base, the first step is it does a recipe marketplace search looking for recipes that are relevant to that question, selects one by reading its descriptive text and options, learns how to use it by reading those options. The model can invoke that recipe on a business unit, extract those data tables, aggregate them by writing SQL queries against that data table to further aggregate it, and ultimately come to some conclusion about what the state of that middleware cache is, or to do an upgrade, or whatever the case might be. In essence, it's making the models stronger at understanding the context of the whole code base, not just the thing that it happens to be looking at any given moment.
So it's I mean, this is in is it's I guess related to going back to what we were talking earlier around sort of, you know, renewing old code, refactoring, identifying, you know, functions that are no longer used, depreciated. I mean, is the state of AI that good these days that it's able to achieve that? I mean, I imagine there must be some level of trust that you have to put in it if it's going to give you, because this stuff is so, you've got vast amounts of code, right? You've got vast amounts of stuff.
That's right. That's right.
An individual can obviously ask Moddy a question and come back with an answer. But in order to analyze whether that answer is correct, it's going to take you a long time.
Absolutely. In this case, you get to see which recipes were called. And so I think it's the hybrid that's important here. And trust is an important consideration. I think of an example from a couple of weeks ago, again, talking to another banking executive, and he was just describing this problem statement to me, which is, I'm trying to move on-prem to containerized applications. The key problem right now that's blocking us is these applications are writing log files to disk.
Yes.
I need them to write logs to sysout instead, because in this containerized environment, I'm going to attach a Splunk agent, which is going to forward it on over here. And so he's describing this problem. And so we know that in various different ways, we need to alter logging configuration and change code itself to not write to disk in this particular way. And I actually described that problem to Claude Code and said, go write the recipes for this. It used to be that writing custom recipes to do these kinds of transformations involved you learning the framework and, you know, becoming an expert at that, at recipe development. But the cost of writing net new custom recipes is trending to zero. In 20 minutes, Claude Code had written out the first 10 or so patterns to modify different kinds of logging configuration and how to root this stuff out. We could take that recipe then, deploy it, and we ran that on the first 9,000 repositories and could see the kinds of change that was being made. So you would look at the patterns and go, okay, you know, actually, I don't quite like that. And so just take that line example, feed that back into the model and say, I don't like this particular iteration on it. It would write another unit test for the recipe, work on the recipe a little bit more. We run it again. So you get that kind of like quick iteration feedback. And at the end of the day, what you have is not a probabilistic system like an LLM making all the edits, but rather the probabilistic system has written the recipe that becomes a deterministic machine to make that change across the whole code base.
So
it's the connection that's important.
So in the real world, it's a bit like, this is going to be a terrible analogy, but I imagine you don't have access to all cookery books, right? But you say, well, I want to make a lasagna, right? So you pick one.
That's right.
And if it's, you know, I'm not saying you're going to go through the whole process, but if you identify by looking at it, the recipe, in this case, a recipe, you know, recipe? Yeah?
Yes,
No, actually, I don't like that particular ingredient. I've never liked it.
Yes.
You can then choose another recipe and
that's right.
Adapt what the first recipe had.
That's right. And then once you are comfortable with that kind of change, now you've got, you know, a deterministic machine to go stamp that out everywhere. And when we say everywhere, I mean, it's hard to imagine just how much code there is at one of our larger customers. It's almost 5 billion lines of source code under management. It's just absolutely incredible. Yes, the amount of, so to ask, if you can imagine the same thing, the token cost alone of just asking a model to go update the same thing across all 5 billion lines, it's unfathomable. But here, you know, you're kind of focusing on writing the recipe, and then the distribution of that is quite cheap.
Yes, I mean, but I guess I mean, going back to the recipe example, it's the people using this system will need to be able to identify what's a good recipe and what's such a good recipe. Why something isn't doing what it should do, even though it might be a perfectly good recipe in another context, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it absolutely is something where you see those staff or principal engineers that really know what they want, really achieve that materially across a whole business unit.
Okay, Jonathan. Well, thank you ever so much for taking part in today's podcast. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.